Savvy regards once again to the staff of Nemeta, student teachers in the Sacred Groves, as well as to guests and visitors to the campus. This is the main professor recording on the 22nd of June, 2019. This is the moment which, as you all know, is generally celebrated as the first day of summer, the day of the summer solstice. In the Gaian calendar, that is not the case, however. In the converted calendar, which is also known as Mirita's calendar, Mirita, M-I-R-I-T-A, the day of the solstice is not the first day of summer, but it's the peak day of summer, truly midsummer. So in Mirita's calendar, summer begins around the 2nd of May and ends around the 4th or 5th of August. So the solstice, the 21st of June, is the midpoint between those two points, which are traditionally known as the cross quarter days of the ancient Celtic calendar. In any case, however you figure it, I'm taking this day as an occasion to make a special presentation to guests and visitors to the campus. I can tell you at the outset that the material I'm presenting to you today, in text and talk, is top priority. It's among the most important content. It contains some of the imperative features of the teaching that I present as a Gnostic and as a proponent of Gaian Tantra or Planetary Tantra, as well as a proponent of Sophianic animism. So here we go. I'm taking a big step today in putting out this material. The title of the text is Against Universality, The Great Descent. So I'm going to be talking to you about the Great Descent. What is the Great Descent? And how you might engage yourself with that event, because the Great Descent is an event in progress. Now, I can assure you that this is a momentous undertaking for me. Try to take that statement on board. That being so, I know that it's even more a tremendous undertaking for you. And it's my intention, which I want you to know at the outset, not to make this matter difficult. It is a difficult matter. It can be an extremely difficult matter. But in starting this talk, I would like to make clear my commitment to all of you, staff and guests alike, that I'm going to do my level best to make this as little difficult as possible. I guess that's about the best way that I could state it. So what is so difficult? What is the problem here? What am I going to be tackling in this talk and the accompanying text? Well, quite simply, I'm going to be tackling the problem of how you perceive your own humanity as it relates to how you perceive the humanity of others. Now, you might not think that your perception of yourself as a human being, a member of the human species, and the attendant perception of others who stand before you in the world, whom you recognize as human, you might think that's it's not a problem, but I'm telling you, you're wrong about that. You're really, really wrong if you think it's not a problem. So it's my intention to point out to you what that problem is, to point to the correction of the problem, well, to indicate the source of the problem, to describe how the problem originated, and to direct you to the solution to that problem, which entails nothing less than an entirely different way to perceive humanity. Not only the humanity in yourself, such as that be, but also as well the humanity in others. So I can assure you that this is some really deep shit we're getting into here, to use the language of the street. And you may wonder why I would choose to put out this material in a public access talk to visitors and guests of Nemeta. After all, being such a steep problem, such a momentous and deep problem, you might think that I would reserve discussion of this problem and elucidation of problem and solution for veterans in Planetary Tantra and for those in the staff, the student teachers who show their commitment to my work by their material and creative participation. But no, it's not like that. You're here because of an interest in Planetary Tantra. And no matter what your grasp or comprehension of that may be, there's something I want you to know at the outset. Practice of Planetary Tantra not only involves, but requires a total revamping of your sense of humanity. And this is where it starts. I want to advise you that this talk and text together are just the introduction to the subject. But I've decided today that I am going to bring this subject in its full elaboration to everyone on Nemeta and not reserve it simply for veterans or people on the staff. It is primary to your participation in Planetary Tantra that you should comprehend and face this problem about the perception of humanity. In order to prime you for that comprehension, I'm going to give you the leading clue going in. Before I say anything else, before I go into the text, in any way, let me give you the leading clue, which tells you really what you will have as the takeaway of this instruction, this particular and unique instruction. So it goes like this. Whether you know it or not, you have been taught to perceive humanity in a certain way. And that way of perceiving humanity is so common to you that you don't question it, that you assume that it could not be otherwise. It's as if when you were born, someone placed a pair of glasses on you, like Google glasses. So you're a newborn child and somebody straps a pair of Google glasses on you, and then you grow and you get older and you get to be 4 or 5 years old or 10 or 20 years old, and you never know what it might be like not to have those glasses strapped to your head. What I'm going to tell you, beginning in this talk and in a couple of follow-up talks, is about how you have been subjected to a tactic of deceit. The way you see the humanity in yourself and the way you see humanity or think you see it, when you look at another human animal, is due to a tactic of deceit. And it's my intention to expose this tactic of deceit. So if I'm successful, you will then have an option, which will be, quite simply, oh, well, there's another way of looking at humanity. Well, I think I'll consider it, because I realize from what John said that the way I've been told to view humanity is wrong. You'll have that option. Secondarily, it's my wish that as a consequence of this particular line of Gnostic instruction, that you will see, as I do, and as some others around me already see, the total and complete imperative necessity for the collapse of Christianity. So there you have it. And on that happy note, let us proceed into the written material. At the top of the text is a photograph, one of many, many thousands that have been taken in various telescopic and photographic techniques, of the interior of the Orion Nebula. At the interior of this nebula is a tight formation of stars known as the trapezium. So the nebula itself is called M42, the Orion Nebula. And the trapezium is this configuration of stars, which you see there, in the form of a trapezoid or trapezium. Extremely famous in the realms of astronomy. You can go research it on the internet. You'll find volumes of photographs and volumes of articles that have been written about this locale. What you will not find in any of those articles is what you find in the Sophianic narrative, the fallen goddess scenario. According to that narrative, the genomic plasm of the anthropine species, from which all strains of the human species emerge, is embedded in the trapezium. It actually hangs in the trapezium like a hammock. The trapezium may be imagined as a kind of cradle. The four most prominent bright stars of the trapezium, plus dozens of others, present a structure upon which the anthropine genome is deposited like dew on a spider's web. And that is exactly how it looks, and that is exactly the analogy you can use to visualize this phenomenon. You know, in my elaboration of the sacred narrative of the mysteries, the fallen goddess scenario, I've been extremely careful to point out those aspects of the scenario which I draw directly from surviving sources, and I cite those sources meticulously. We can call that first degree material. Second degree material, I specify as elaborations or extrapolations based upon the sources. You get that difference? Not directly or literally found in the sources, but extrapolated from the sources with great care, I must add. And then there is a third degree of material in the FGS, and that is novel or accessory material, which I have actually added. So I have added to the narrative, inherited from the Magi, the Magian order, the Gnostic schools, concerning the cosmology of our planet and the origins of the human species. I have added to that material the detail that the Anthropine genome is deposited in M42, the Orion Nebula. I do that quite simply on the basis of my investigations as a shaman. Well, my investigations as a shaman are exactly the same as the shamanic investigations of the Teleste, who initially developed the fallen goddess scenario. So even though I may here and there, very rarely, add a new element, as I've done here, I do so consistent with the method in which the narrative was developed in the first place. Clear enough? All right. So I've said in my little introduction, a little longer than I would like it to have been, that this topic is all about how you perceive humanity. Well, those who take an interest in the fallen goddess scenario, which is at the core of planetary tantra, might also take a clue for their perception of humanity from the Petalia amulet. I've cited this amulet in a number of other units on Nemata. It contains, among others, these three lines. The lines are stated in the first person, I. That indicates that they represent the confession or declaration of someone who has undergone an initiation. In the lines preserved on the tablet, which is a thin leaf of beaten gold inscribed with writing, the neophyte testifies to the experience of initiation in this way. I am a child of earth and starry heaven, but my origins are in heaven alone. You yourselves know this. So with those three simple lines, you already have a basis for the perception of the humanity in yourself and in others. You have literally a basis to perceive the origins of humanity, which are in heaven alone. And when you look at the Orion Nebula, which you can see with the naked eye, although you can't see the trapezium itself, but when you look toward that blur in the sky, located on the right thigh of the figure of Orion, who is inarguably the most widely known and recognized celestial constellation of all, you are actually looking at the location of your origins. So, moving on in the text, I bring up as a point of departure a most hideous citation from the mainstream media. And there you'll see that I've linked a 6-minute clip, and I've extracted in audio about 40 seconds from that clip. In those 40 seconds, we hear a hideous creature in the USSA government making a statement. She is objecting to the fact that the President of the United States referred to certain people as animals. Of course, in tantric, Gaian tantric cosmology and in planetary tantra, we consider ourselves as animals. So from our viewpoint, this is not an insult. We obviously have a completely different concept of animals than ordinary people do. But as you would all know, to call someone an animal in a routine and mundane way is to insult them, to place them in a derogatory or inferior or undesirable status compared to a human being. So the President of the United States used animal as an insulting and degrading term in referring to some members of the well-known Mexican gang M13 who have been known from time to time to commit some pretty brutal and sadistic acts. But this creature from the House of Congress in the United States really protested. And she stated her view that it was really unacceptable for the president to call these Mexican gang members animals just because they butchered a couple of teenage girls alive with machetes. And they've done far worse than that. And she stated her protest in the language of the strictly Judeo-Christian view of humanity. And you listen to her words there for 40 seconds, you know. We are all God's children. And there is a spark of divinity in everyone. And how can it be? Does the president not believe in the dignity and worth of every person? Because if you do, then you would see the humanity in these M13 gang members. And you would respect the dignity and worth of those gang members based on your perception of the humanity and the essence of humanity that resides in them as it resides in you. So how do you like that proposition? How would you like to go along with that? If you stood right now on the street in front of one of those members, tattooed members of the M13 gang, and looked him in the eyes, are you going to see in him the same humanity that you see in yourself? Do you feel obligated to? Well, according to Nancy Pelosi, you damn well do feel obligated to. And if you don't show that you hold this way of perceiving, then you are inhumane, and there is something less than human about you. All of that enforcement, it really is an enforcement. Let me put it in this way. The implicit enforcement in the obligation to view humanity in that way is fundamental to the Judeo-Christian view of the human species. And it is just that view that has to be broken. That view is actually an evil spell that has been cast upon you that prevents you from having another kind of perception of humanity. So if you are willing to accept that a false sense of humanity and a false perception of humanity has been imposed on you, then you may be willing to consider that there is another way to look at humanity. And that's where I'm going in these talks. So the next section is titled Spark of Divinity. And there I cover some really important points about this concept that all human beings have a spark of divinity in them. And I go into the background of this concept, and I show that, as a matter of fact, the Gnostics were wrongly accused of holding the view that we are sparks of divinity who have lost ourselves in the darkness and evil of material existence. That is not a genuine Gnostic view, although it is widely and almost unanimously considered to be one. Those of you who are listening now, and let's say who have read Not in His Image, will know that I've taken considerable effort to refute this view, which is called scholars call it the anti-cosmism of the Gnostics, anti-cosmic. The claim that Gnostics rejected the material world, the claim that they considered it to be the creation of an inferior or satanic deity, is entirely wrong. And I've corrected it in a number of ways on a number of occasions. So what I do here in this text is simply reiterate a couple of the main points of my refutation. For instance, you will find in the Nag Hammadi materials, which are written in a Greek Coptic melange, that there is a distinction between the use of the word cosmos and the use of the word kaz. And kaz, K-A-Z, is the Coptic variant of the Greek geia, or ge, G-E, meaning the earth. Well, those texts, if you read them meticulously, distinguish the earth from the cosmos or the system. So for Gnostics, the word cosmos, which is best translated as system in this sense, was something negative, more comparable to the matrix. According to the Gnostics, we live on the earth, kaz, geia, which is the body of the Aeon Sophia, immaterial immanence. And that is not a prison, that is not a delusion, that is not a matrix. But there is a system of deceit imposed upon us within this natural world we inhabit. So the natural world is not evil, but the system of deceit imposed upon us directs us away from the truth. And to that extent, it can be considered to be evil, that is to say, working against life. So there you go. There are many ways to state this proposition, and I've talked about it many, many times in my interviews on the internet and so forth. The spark of divinity lost in the murk and darkness of the material world is, when you actually examine that paradigm and go looking for the cultural and textual roots, it is, you will find, a teaching of Talmudic Judaism and the Kabbalah. As a matter of fact, I put Spark of Divinity into the search engine, went and clicked on images, and guess what was the first image that came up? Is a painting, which I reproduce here, on the site Chabad.org. And Chabad.org is a platform for the theology and ideology and dogma of Chabad Lubavitch, which is the leading Talmudic sect in the world. Chabad Lubavitch is also an extremely potent political and financial influence in the world. As a matter of fact, the Yehudi concept of correction, which is called Tikkun Olam, is based on this narrative that there are sparks of divinity who have fallen away from unity in the Godhead, fallen into material darkness, and need to be recovered, collected out of the darkness, and restored to unity in the Godhead. That, in a sentence, is the basic theological proposition of Chabad Lubavitch and of Talmudic Judaism. Now it remains to be seen if these, quote, sparks of divinity, unquote, are descriptions of some divine essence, immaterial spiritual essence that abides in all human animals, or if it only abides in certain human animals who are of a superior status in the species, or may even belong to a higher species than what we commonly recognize as human. So there you go. And from that topic, I segue back to the topic of the Orion Nebula. I do so because I want you all to be perfectly clear on where you come from. You know, you don't have to imagine where you come from. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to speculate. You don't have to make believe. You don't have to make up some story. You don't have to attribute where you, as a living human creature, come from to some kind of fantasy that you concoct or someone else has concocted in the Urantia book, for instance, or in Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine. No. All you have to do is go out at the right time of the year and look at the sky. Many, many people around the world, even though they don't exactly know what they're seeing, recognize the form of the constellation of Orion, the Skywalker, as the Egyptians called him, or as they are thought to have named that constellation. Asar, I believe. My Egyptian is a little rusty these days. Skywalker. You see this mammoth figure walking across the sky with a characteristic belt. And there, hanging down on the right side of the figure, on its right side, you see this blotch. That's the Orion Nebula. That's where you come from. Everything is material. I know there are some of you by now, or I suspect, I won't say I know, that's a bit arrogant. I suspect there are some of you by now who get a bit of a thrill every time I say that. Everything is material. The human genome is a material plasm consisting of a nucleic acid substrate, which is a fluidic medium distributed across the stars of the trapezium in the Orion Nebula. And that is such. That is a fact. It is an inarguable fact. It is not make-believe. It is not an hypothesis. So how wonderful it is that if you want to see the origin of your own material being, you can go out in the sky and look at it, and do look at it. Do contemplate that beautiful vision on some occasion, on every occasion when you have the opportunity. You'll see what it does to you to look in that direction and know what you are seeing. Now, proceeding with the written text, following my comment on the Orion Nebula with these illustrations, I introduce the acronym TAD, TAD. And I propose to use this word to replace the word people. For some time now, I've been, I won't say uncomfortable, but I don't really enjoy the word people. It always makes me think of People magazine. And I see myself standing in the supermarket checkout line with a can of tuna and a quart of milk, looking at the latest issue of People magazine. People, people, the peeps. I really don't like this word. When you talk about the dignity and worth of the human person, to me the word people does not convey that. So I came up with this abbreviation, TAD, which stands for tertiary anthropine derivative, which is pretty fancy, you gotta admit. I mean, it's a fine day of the week when you can invent something like that. As a matter of fact, it's quite precise Gnostic language, tertiary anthropine derivative. So anthropine refers, of course, to the anthropos, the anthropine species. Are you materially, right now, as an individual specimen, as a human animal, a single human animal, standing on 2 feet, with 2 arms and a head, like all the other human animals, unless they're born in a mutilated condition, are you the embodiment of the anthropine genome that is suspended materially in the Orion Nebula? Well, yes and no. You are a derivative of it, but you are not a pure embodiment of it. Think of raw milk. Suppose that you never knew that raw milk existed and that it came from cows. Suppose you only knew that milk was a beverage you buy in the supermarket. There are people, by the way, who are in this condition, I can assure you. So there's milk that you buy in the supermarket. So you come home with a carton of milk. And let's say you decided to try something new and you saw, oh, chocolate milk. So you come home with a carton of chocolate milk. You open it, you pour it out a glass, and you drink it. And what are you tasting? You're tasting pasteurized milk, probably milk that has been subjected to UHT, ultra-high temperature, for preservation. And it has chocolate added to it. So that milk is a derivative of raw milk. But you might need not even know that raw milk exists. You have never encountered raw milk. Likewise, you have never encountered a direct, explicit incarnation of the anthropine genome. You yourself are not that. You are a derivative. You are a racial derivative. You're a TAD, a tertiary anthropine derivative. Why tertiary? Well, I explain in the text that the first condition of the anthropos is its condition within the pleromic core. The fallen goddess scenario, sacred narrative, says that the human genome was designed, let me get out of the passive voice, it says that 2 aeons, Sophia and Thelete, designed and calibrated the human genome in the galactic core. So the first time that the human genome was actually formed, it existed in the galactic core. Yes, there is nucleic acid in the galactic core. It's not exactly the same as nucleic acid appears outside the core, but it is the same substance, okay? So that's the first degree of the genome, nucleic acid in the core. The second degree of the anthropine genome is the nucleic acid outside the core. The great film in the form of dew on a spider's web of nucleic acid deposited in M42. That's the second degree or the second derivative condition. Then, how does it happen that that genome in the Orion Nebula comes to propagate itself in planetary systems? Well, the propagules of the genome, which are like freeze-dried granules of coffee, if you will, granules of freeze-dried coffee, these propagules, they turn into propagules once they are drawn out of the nebula on fine filaments of plasmic electrical currents. And these filaments of plasmic electrical currents run through the entire region of the galactic arms. And the propagules of the anthropos carried on these filaments eventually, soon or later, by chance, find an hospitable planetary environment, because there are many, many planets in the galactic limbs. I'm talking about just our galaxy alone, the Orion galaxy, as it's called. And so they drop into the atmosphere as flakes or grains, and they fertilize, they become fertilized by the conditions of the atmosphere, and this is how human beings emerge in the environment of a planetary laboratory. And that is the third condition, tertiary. So, let me be the one to break the news to you. You're a tad. I'm a tad. Everybody's a tad. People are tads. And I'm going to practice calling people tads and using that word instead of people, saying, well, some tads this and some tads that, and that tad sitting over there in the corner sucking on a beer. It might have occurred to you that this particular term, this particular way of speaking of people, carries the allusion to tadpoles. And isn't it true that the male sperm that fertilize the ovum and produce or reproduce the human species by what is called meiosis look exactly like tadpoles? So every one of you tads, including myself, is here because a spermatic tadpole managed to burrow its way into one of the ova, one of the eggs, that was sliding down the channel of the fallopian tubes of a woman. And that's just the plain facts of the case. Now, you'll note in the text that I make a point, which I've already made before. I'm going to continue to emphasize. Bear with me if I get repetitive. Some things bear repeating. You are a derivative of the human species, appearing in a racial strain. No one embodies or can embody the genomic root identity itself. Do you see that? That is a material fact. No one can embody the genomic root identity. You can only embody a derivative, a racial strain of that identity. Everything is material, and what is true for the material is true for everything else as well. What is true for the material is true for the ethical, the ideological, and the psychological. If it is true for the material that no human being born of a woman, due to the unity of sperm and ovum, can embody the genomic root identity, if that is materially true, biologically true, then it is also true that there can be no truthful image of the anthropos as a genomic identity. Nevertheless, you have lived all your life with that image, haven't you? There is an image unique in the world, an image of a man, a male member of the human species, who is said to embody the genomic root identity. And that image of Jesus, or of Jesus slash Christ, the human-divine hybrid, is a hateful deceit. It's not just a deceit. It's not just a lie. It's a hateful deceit that has been planted in the mind of the human races by a race that sets itself apart and hates them all. As I've said before, and I can only try to say it again as cogently and eloquently as possible, as I've said before, in the form of a question: if you receive the image of your own humanity from a group that places itself outside humanity and hates you, what could possibly go wrong? What could possibly arise that would harm you and defeat you in your humanity if you derive your image of humanity in that way, from that source? And I want you to be absolutely sure of one thing. If you do not take away anything else from this talk, you, every single one of you, and I'm speaking to you now, each to each, individually, you need to realize that your image of humanity, your sense of humanity, and your ability to perceive humanity when you look at other people and when you look into yourself has been given to you. It is not your own product. It is not the product of your own heart or your own sensibility or the powers of your own imagination. But, hold on. There is a way of perceiving humanity materially that can be all that. There is a way of perceiving and sensing humanity in yourself and others that can be your own product. But you can only achieve that on the other side of the Great Descent. This challenge requires that you overthrow and reject entirely the view of humanity that has been given to you. You must recognize who gave it to you. The source of it is no mystery. The source of it is not something to speculate about. Everybody knows who gave to the human races their universalist sense of humanity. Everybody knows that. And that is what you must reject. The sense and image of humanity coming from that source. The great descent, as you might say, a negative and a positive aspect, it has a rejecting or defiant aspect. It is an act of defiance, but it also has an affirmative aspect. First, in the great descent, you defy and deny and reject the sense and image of humanity that has been given to you. And then, in the affirmative aspect of this event, of this great, great undertaking, you find the sense and image of humanity that comes as your own product. It's yours because you make it yourself, because you fabricate it out of the very material of your own soul and psyche, out of your intellect and imagination. It is your own creation. It is your own project and not something that you received from an alien source. So, if you're with me so far, and this is a steep, steep hall. I think you can see that by now. If you're with me so far, we'll just go into the home stretch. I'll skim quickly over the remainder of the text. You'll note there that I bring up the issue of eugenics. I discuss the term salutary respect, which occurs in this remarkable citation from a book by the historian Arnold Toynbee and Daisaku Ikeda, who apparently was a Japanese intellectual. Remarkable citation. And in that passage that comes under the subheading of what, human dignity, I point out that both Christianity and communism are firmly based on this concept of universal humanity, which has been given to you. I know of no other citation in all of my work, all of my studies and research, that is as clear as the one I present here. What Toynbee and his collaborator say is so important. Communism is an outcome of Christianity. Of course it is. And communism is an outcome of Talmudic Judaism. Of course it is. And the concept of the proletariat, the international, you know, that's a cliche, that's a meme from communism. What is the international? Well, it's the group of the mass of people who can be all lumped together, no matter what country, what origin, what race they come from, what culture they were brought up in. They can all be massed together as an international or corporate body. And they are the oppressed. And communism claims to fight for the liberation of the oppressed and to bring justice to the oppressed. And that whole ideology and agenda crumbles before your eyes when the prop of universality is removed. This concept, it's not only a concept, but it's a sense and it's an iconic image all in one. That complex of universality props up communism. And it comes from Christianity. It comes out of the Judeo-Christian belief system and the Abrahamic religions. How does Islam factor into this equation? Well, I'll just give you a wild guess. Since Islam means submission, then everyone who submits and becomes a Muslim belongs to the same faceless corporate mass of humanity. So when one Muslim looks at another through the eyes of a Muslim, a follower of Islam, that Muslim sees a reflection of his or her own humanity in the face of the other Muslim. Can you see that? But what they see is an illusion and a lie. It's as if there is some real entity or agency, as if there is some true and genuine presence existing in that faceless recognition. The recognition of 1.6 billion faceless zombies for one another. That's the universality of Islam. It's the same scam. It's the same lie. It's the same hateful deceit. The Abrahamic religions all have the same root, and that is the archaic deceit of the Zedekim. Coming around to the conclusion of the text, there are just two more points I would like to highlight. First one, I might give you in the form of a recitation. It's only one short sentence, and you can certainly memorize it, if I may be so bold to say so. It could be one of the more important things you ever learn in your entire life. And it goes like this. The Anthropos is purely imaginal, extra-biological. Races are existential, biologically real. Two sentences, actually. Can you handle two sentences? Now, you may have a question about my use of the term extra-biological or exobiological. There is actually a word, exobiology. It refers, I believe, to the existence of biological creatures and entities outside the atmosphere of the earth. Exobiology. Is the Anthropos exobiological? Absolutely. Purely on material terms. It is a plasm. It is a gently throbbing, well, gently, on a scale of millions of light years, a gently throbbing membrane of a biological plasm deposited extraterrestrially. So it is exobiological, but it's still biological. It's still material. The Anthropos is purely imaginal, exobiological, but races are existential, biologically real. There, I made it into one sentence for you. Is that easier? I want to make it easy, believe me, I do. And I've got to warn you, that's what's coming in the continuity of this talk. What's coming in the completion of this topic is a game changer like nothing you've ever seen before. It's brewing. It's brewing like a storm. It's getting strong. And when it breaks like a thunderhead, I'll be there to tell you what's happening and to read the weather. I'm not just going to read this for the staff. I'm going to read this for everyone who comes into PT. Why do you come into PT? Why are you interested? Why are you here? Why did you sign up for Namita to be a guest and a member? You want to know who you really are. You want to know what you're really looking at when you walk down the street and you look at other human beings streaming towards you on the sidewalk? Do you want to know what you're really looking at? Do you want to know what to look at? What to look at? That's an instruction. You've never been told what to look at when you cast your eyes and cast your gaze over your fellow human beings. All those other tads, right? All those tads out there on the street. The reality of it is, you have been told what to see in humanity, but you have not been taught how to see humanity. So who's going to teach you how to see humanity? Well, that's an assignment that's bound to be rather unique, obviously. And so it goes to you, a unique entity, but actually it goes to you a unique process. So the Maitreya can teach you how to see humanity, how to perceive it, and how to perceive the racial strains of humanity, and to know the distinction. But the Maitreya only does that by engaging you in a process of which you are also the source. You cannot undertake the process without becoming yourself a source for the process. This is how deep it runs, as the discourse now takes us in the direction of this great, great question, of this great challenge, the great descent. So finally, I close on a text with an image, probably one of the top five religious images in the world, which is the sculpture known as the Pietà of Michelangelo. So there you have Mary, the Virgin Mary, the mother of the human-divine hybrid, who is said to embody the perfection and essence of humanity in a way that no other human being can. And there he is, limp and dead, a corpse in the laps of his mother. And you are supposed to celebrate this image, not only as the picture or icon of your own humanity, but as that which gives you the sense of that humanity. Do you have a sense of your humanity when you look at this limp, dead corpse, a victim of torture? Is that where you get your sense of humanity? From a tortured corpse? Well, many people do. And that is a fucking inarguable fact, isn't it? Just savor it for a moment. This is how far it's gone. This is how bad it's gone and how rotten it's gone. And people like Nancy Pelosi, and there are millions and millions of them, are operating in righteousness out of a sense of humanity that has gone totally rotten as any fruit or any piece of meat that ever came under your nose. Welcome to Kali Yuga. It's a time of the most extreme decadence and degradation of humanity, but also the moment of spectacular and unparalleled realizations, which are sudden realizations, sudden and immediate realizations.